Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a look at the year in technology. First, the number of homicides in Milwaukee dropped about 15% this year compared to 2016. Still, about 120 people died a violent death, mostly from gunfire. Milwaukee police say they hope they've found a way to keep down the number of murders. But as Chuck Kornbach reports, there's caution in the community because a lot of things can affect the homicide total.
Looking at who was killed in Milwaukee this year, young African-American men continued by far to be the majority of victims. The Milwaukee Police Department says 80% of the dead were black males and 70% were between the ages of 10 and 40. One of the youngest victims was 16-year-old Imani Robinson, who was caught in a crossfire outside a grocery store. At a neighborhood vigil in July, Robinson's mother, Latasha Davis, spoke about her son.
He was funny. He had a big heart. He helped everybody. His smile was contagious. He loved the dance. And that's exactly what I'm going to miss about all of it.
In another high-profile killing, a City of Milwaukee housing inspector, Greg Ziskevich, was shot in March during an attempted carjacking. After three young men were charged with the shooting of the employee, nicknamed Ziggy, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett called it a very difficult time.
This is still a personal nightmare for Ziggy's family. It's still a personal nightmare for the city family and for all people in this community who want this to be a better city.
There could have been far more homicides in Milwaukee. The police department says the number of non-fatal shootings in the city has gone up about 2% this year to about 560. But at a recent news conference, Police Chief Ed Flynn said the number of shootings and other violent crimes went down this fall in part of the city where officers conducted a traffic enforcement surge. Flynn says a similar effort will start next month.
We believe we can sustain this responsibly, and we're going to undertake to do that while we develop longer-term plans to make this a permanent part of our interventions.
Mayor Barrett says there are other initiatives coming by spring from a blueprint for peace developed by the city's Office of Violence Prevention. The mayor says one program will use so-called interrupters in troubled neighborhoods.
These are not police officers. These are people who are trying to make sure that we are dealing with problems that they find out about before it reaches the point of violence, so to stop it before it escalates.
Barrett says he also worries about other factors that may be linked to homicides, like the availability of guns and the opiate and heroin crisis. Milwaukee Common Council member Terry Witkowski is vice chair of the Public Safety Committee. He also points to drug crime.
This does need to be addressed. It's not only law enforcement, but it has to be the community, it has to be treatment, and it has to involve people's support system, their family.
This year's Milwaukee homicide victims will be remembered tomorrow afternoon at an annual event called Milwaukee Lights a Candle for Change. It'll be held here at Our Savior's Lutheran Church.
Jesus, oh, what a wonderful time. I said Jesus.
Reverend Patrick Keene led the singing at a prayer service at the church on Wednesday, and he'll speak at tomorrow's event. He hopes violence can be reduced more by going beyond police, guns, and drugs and focusing on improving the quality of life.
We say that the biggest problem in Milwaukee is violent crime. And my response is that's a damned lie. It's the result of other problems. The number one problem is probably education and then employment and then housing and then transportation.
Keene urges governments to address those issues. But while waiting for what may take years, the pastor says he tries to reach individuals with a message of nonviolence.
That it's on us. If we want to see a difference, we can make the difference by being the difference.
Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now WPR Milwaukee reporter Chuck Kornbach joins us to talk a little bit more about the homicide rate in the city this year. Chuck, thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Now, in your report, it said that the homicide rate is down in 2017 compared to 2016, but how does it compare to the overall rate in the last maybe 10 years or so?
Well, the numbers this year are 118 right now, according to the stats using the FBI uniform crime reporting criteria, 118 homicides. About 85% of the victims were shot to death. The 118 number is lower than last year's, we've been saying, also quite a bit lower than 2 years ago, which was a big spike in Milwaukee in homicides, where 145 were people were killed. Now, before that, in the preceding 7 or 8 years, the number hovered down below 100 for the most part, as low as 71 in 2008. So there was this big spike in 2015, still not the record of 165 in 1991, but still a big spike in 2015 that's come down a little bit and come down further this year.
And Chuck, you did say that while the homicide rate is down, the non-fatal gun violence is actually up slightly. What impact has that had on the police department and their policing efforts?
Right. The numbers of non-fatal shootings, according to the Milwaukee Police, up about 2% this year over last year, but again, down about 60 or 65 from 2015 when there was that spike in homicides. You know, the shootings have put continued to make headlines, both the fatal and non-fatal. The police department is under some political fire. Ed Flynn, the chief, has been, you know, the subject of discussions at the Common Council. The Milwaukee Common Council is asking the state legislature for power to fire the police chief. We'll see if the Republicans that control the state capitol will give them that. There's also talk of Republicans overhauling the Fire and Police Commission in Milwaukee, the largely citizen panel that oversees fire and police. Mayor Barrett, Tom Barrett of Milwaukee, has opposed changes in the Fire Police Commission. He's also stood behind Chief Flynn.
Now, in your feature, Chuck, you mentioned some of the preventative actions and programs that are being implemented in Milwaukee for the next year. What's your sense of how much the communities themselves and the individuals in those communities and the leaders in those communities have been part of shaping these programs instead of just having them kind of imposed on them?
Well, this Blueprint for Peace that we mentioned did seem to have a wide variety of people involved in them, and I'll read quickly the six goals
sure.
or indicators. Stop the shooting, promote healing and restorative justice, support children, youth, and families, advance economic opportunity, foster safe and strong neighborhoods, and strengthen the capacity and coordination of violence prevention efforts. And so that's getting a little bit of what Pastor Keene said at the end of the story about addressing some of the issues that may be leading to the violence, the lack of economic opportunity, not enough education opportunity, and so on. So there is this sort of broad-based effort, but even Pastor Keene says, well, it's just a program. We'll have to see what pans out.
And of course, there's a lot of focus, understandably, on prevention and then also catching perpetrators when, unfortunately, prevention doesn't work. But then there's also finding justice and some kind of closure for victims and the loved ones of the victims. You've profiled a couple cases in your feature of Imani Robinson and Greg Ziskevich. How are those cases making their way through the court system right now?
Well, there will be courtroom action on both next year, it seems. In the Imani Robinson case, two men were arrested in connection with the case, but police say a third man, who was allegedly part of the crossfire and the crossfire that killed Imani Robinson, I don't think he's been located. He's not been arrested. At least police have not come forward with a charge, and DAs have not come forward with a charge for this third person. So it's a rather complex case, I think. In the other case involving Mr. Ziskevich, or Ziggy, three men were arrested, and they face trials, and that will get a lot of attention. But as we reported earlier this year, and others have certainly reported over the years, not everyone who commits murder or alleged to commit murder in the city gets all the way to found guilty or arrested even. There's often a high percentage of cases that go unsolved. Right now, for the 2017 homicides, and granted it's relatively early, arrests have only been made in 42% of the cases, 58 no arrests made. It sort of points to the difficulty sometimes of proving cases, getting convictions, and then getting that closure.
Well, and often, Chuck, it really relies on community coming forward, people feeling like they can trust the police to testify or give information to the police. And certainly Milwaukee has suffered from difficulties in the community police relationships, not just from the Dontre Hamilton case of a few years ago, but ongoing.
Right. Do the citizens trust the police and the law enforcement establishment to go ahead and make cases and yet keep people that may have witnessed something safe? There is that lack of trust in some cases that they're trying to rebuild, and maybe this blueprint will help rebuild it, but it is a problem. And there's some, you know, community efforts to go ahead and try to help the police or help get cases solved. But those will come out in this interrupters case that Mayor Barrett was talking about, or other efforts to sort of informally help the police.
Well, Chuck, we'll certainly check back in with you as some of those programs get going and find out how they're working for Milwaukee.
Thank you.
Chuck Kornbach is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about Milwaukee's murder rate this year and what local leaders are hoping to do to bring those numbers down. Right now, we're looking back to talk about some of the biggest stories in technology of 2017. Joining us is Shira Ovide, technology reporter for Bloomberg Gadfly. Welcome to Central Time, Shira.
Thanks very much.
So, Shira, you wrote a piece ranking 8 of the biggest themes in tech this year. I want to start off by talking about your number one item, and that is technology's reckoning. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one theme that was so clear this year was some of the darker sides of technology products and the companies behind them. So most prominently was probably this year the Russia investigation and their influence into the 2016 election. It roped in Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other technology companies because it became clear that Kremlin-backed groups used those digital platforms to spread misinformation, to try to sow division among Americans, and the social media companies became a very useful tool to do that, and that has invited some very unwelcome questions and potential regulation into the backyards of some of the biggest and most powerful technology companies in the world.
So if there's fault to be assigned, would you put that on the products and the companies producing the products, or more by consumers using these platforms, perhaps not in the most responsible way?
Look, I think there's plenty of blame to go around, that in some ways big technology hangouts like Facebook are reflections of society, right? So if they're corrupt, it's in part because we're corrupt too. But it's also true that these companies, they got huge numbers of people using them, billions of people in the case of both Facebook and Google. And for a long time, they didn't necessarily have to tackle the downsides of these kinds of technologies, whether it was they became these kind of hotbeds for hatred, or that misinformation spread much more quickly than truth, and that, you know, these products in some cases are addictive. You can just look at how much time people spend staring at their smartphones, right? So they didn't necessarily have to take responsibility for some of those downsides for a long time. And I think this year it became clear that there were so many drawbacks to some of these technologies that the companies had no choice but to start to acknowledge the problems and try to deal with them.
Right. It almost seems like up until this year, a lot of these big tech companies and platforms were almost touting the fact that they weren't taking responsibility. They probably wouldn't have put it that way, but that, you know, they were allowing these platforms to kind of grow in an organic way without them overmanaging it. But that really kind of came home to roost in 2017.
I think that's exactly it. And I think for a long time, for good reasons, right, they were more or less hands-off and said, look, the way to fight misinformation is with more information, right? We need to have this be a free and open place for communication. That's what the internet was sort of built to be about, right? That there were no moderators, that this was a free place where people could exchange ideas and communicate and, you know, create content that people wanted to see and read. And now it's unclear exactly how they put the genie in a bottle, back in the bottle, in a responsible way. Do you want Facebook and Google to sort of say what's okay and what's not okay to say online? I think most people are uncomfortable with that idea, but at the same time, the status quo is not okay either.
We're talking with Shira Ovideh, technology reporter for Bloomberg Gadfly. We're looking back at the year in technology. And Shira, you also talk about the Me Too movement, which certainly really was kind of on everyone's list in some way or another. But you specifically look at it as a moment in the tech industry. Why was the tech industry so affected by the Me Too movement?
Yeah, well, I think the misconduct allegations were maybe less visible in technology than they were in some other areas like politics and like media and entertainment. But the issue here is that the technology industry has always presented itself as a pure meritocracy, right? That no one cared where you went to school or who your parents were. The only thing that mattered was the quality of your ideas and how hard you worked. And I think obviously that's not true, and I think that's become something that the industry has had to reckon with the last few years. The fact is, the majority of employees at most tech companies are largely white or Asian men. Women have been talking about discrimination, both kind of misconduct, sexual misconduct kind of discrimination, and just sort of petty acts of discrimination for a long time, and same for people of color. And I think the industry has, again, sought to reckon with that. As it's become more powerful, those kinds of inequities have become more glaring.
You know, it seems like in some ways for the Me Too movement of this year, there was the initial kind of shock and revelation with the Bill Cosby case. And then, you know, really coming out in so many areas this year. It also feels like Gamergate, where women in gaming were being attacked really viciously, was almost kind of that precursor for the Me Too movement in the tech industry this year as well.
I think that's right. Yeah, and I think there's a connection right between the first topic we talked about, which is this tech reckoning, and this Me Too movement. And that's Gamergate is kind of a thread between both of those, right? That it was both about women not having a safe place in the technology industry, and also about social media being used as a way to kind of harass and attack people of underrepresented groups.
So Amazon obviously is a huge player in the tech industry and more, and now even expanding further with its purchase of Whole Foods this year. You know, when Amazon became such a player, there was concern that, you know, online shopping and this online retail giant was going to do away with brick and mortar stores. And here they are buying brick and mortar stores. What does this mean for tech and for consumers?
Yeah, it's really ironic, isn't it? So a few things. One, you're right. Amazon, it was very clear this company is inescapable. They're a beast in online shopping. They have this sort of new hit with these Echo voice-activated home speakers. I think this splurge into grocery with the Whole Foods purchase was really surprising. But to me, you're right that the purchase of Whole Foods is, in a way, an admission of weakness on the part of Amazon. They've been trying to get big in groceries for 10 years on their own with an online delivery service. It clearly wasn't working. And, you know, the way to make it work, Amazon decided, was to buy 450 brick-and-mortar stores. And that's not their only bet on physical retailer now opening physical bookstores in a number of cities. They have sort of mini Amazon stores within a handful of Kohl's department stores in Chicago and Los Angeles. So, you know, this is a company that was born online, that did basically all of their business online, and now they're starting to realize, wait, you know, 90%+ of U.S. retail sales happen in physical stores. Maybe we need to get in on that too.
So this is this next item is one that is really kind of visible in many different areas, and it's a focus on video. And certainly video is nothing really new, but Facebook and other popular social media apps have really been rewarding users and sometimes even paying users to create video content. Why is there such a big push for video?
I think it's been a really interesting transformation of the internet. Part of it is that with now that most people have smartphones and the cellular networks are pretty fast, we can now have videos with us on the go, and it's not this kind of slow, pokey experience that you and I probably remember even from just a few years ago with buffering and all this terrible experience. So part of it is just the maturation of our smartphone networks, and part of it is, look, if you look at the television industry, and television viewing, it has been the most popular form of entertainment across the world for decades. Americans, on average, watch 4+ hours of television every day, and that's an incredibly alluring target if you're a company like Facebook or Google, where you have 1+ billion users, and you look at all the time that people are spending on TV. You want those people to spend their time with you, and you want the advertising money that's going into Super Bowl ads to be spent on Facebook and Google and not on CBS and NBC. So, that's been a really interesting shift, and it's going to continue to be a big bet by these tech companies that the internet is going to be more and more video driven.
But video also takes up a lot more bandwidth and has implications for infrastructure. Is that of any concern for either platforms like Facebook or the hardware producers who are trying to keep up with these trends?
It's an incredibly important question, and one that too few people pay attention to. Yeah, I'm incredibly worried about whether the infrastructure that we have, both the broadband to our homes and the cellular networks to our smartphones, whether they can support the entire internet basically turning over to this kind of web video experience. I don't know what that's going to do to our infrastructure and who's going to pay for it.
Well, Shira, in just the last 30 seconds or so, are there any fun new releases in technology that got you excited this year?
I'm not a big video game person, but I know a lot of people who love games and are addicted to the Nintendo Switch, which is this kind of clever Nintendo handheld device that they released this year and that took off like wildfire.
All right. Well, we'll take a look at that. Thanks so much for joining us, Shira.
My pleasure.
That was Shira Ovideh, tech reporter for Bloomberg Gadfly. She joined us to talk about the big themes in technology for 2017. First, in just a few short days, people the world over will be ringing in 2018. For many, that means popping some champagne, spending time with friends, and celebrating the end of 2017. And what better way to greet the new year than to have some tasty food on hand to share with friends and family? And our next guest has some fun and delicious recipes that will be crowd pleasers wherever you bring them. Lazarus Lynch is known as the son of a Southern chef and is an entertainment chef from Queens, New York. He focuses on Southern cooking, and he's also the host of Food Network's digital series, Comfort Nation. Lazarus, great to have you back on Central Time.
Thank you, Judith. It's an honor. Thank you.
So what was New Year's like growing up for you?
Well, I grew up in a huge food family, so food was always a central part of New Year's and bringing in the New Year. But church was also a really important thing that we did as kids. We went to church, almost 5 days out of the week. And so New Year's was no different. We would spend, from 9 o'clock at night to about 12 midnight, we would spend our time in church. Then we would go home and we would tear up some really good food.
You
and
earned
that's
it
what
after
we were all
that,
looking
right?
For. Exactly.
And so what kind of food was it that you went home for after that long church service?
Well, it's interesting. My church was predominantly African-American based, so there was a lot of Caribbean members and members from the South. So there were actually people who would have food at the end of the service and, cakes and collations. And when we would go home, my household looked the same way. My father from the South, from Alabama. So we would have my dad's salmon croquettes. At that point, it's in the morning. So we would basically eat breakfast foods. And then my mother from Guyana would have curry chicken and roti, and she would have sarl, which is a popular drink from Guyana, and that's how we would eat. But we would always start first. My brother can witness to this. We would always start off first with dessert because the idea is if you start off the year sweet, everything will be sweet.
Wow. I can get behind that. That's a pretty good theory. So how do you approach New Year's now? Has it changed much, or are there elements that you've kept all these years?
Well, a lot has changed. I mean, for one, we still go to church. We still spend time in church together as a family, and then we come home. I think last year I ordered some Chinese food. I'm really not sure how that happened. But it changes every year. Our family has grown. We're not kids anymore. You know, we have new members of the family. So we try to find out who has the biggest house, and we try to go there. So it's usually our house, my mom's house. And we all stay there, and, you know, we open up some gifts sometimes. And this year, I think we're going to have all of our items ready to go, all of our food ready to go, all of our sides. And we start out the year with some quiche. We start out with prayer, and yeah, that's what we do.
We're definitely going to dig into some of the recipes that you shared with us. But I also want to go back to something you said, Lazarus, that your family has grown. And I'm guessing with that growth, there have been new and different traditions that have also been incorporated. Are there some elements that wouldn't have been around maybe 20, 30 years ago, but because of new members of the family, you do things differently or you've added to it?
Great question, Judith. Well, for one, we have tons of Wi-Fi passwords all around the house, which 20 years ago was not a thing. Because everyone comes and they want to, you know, the first thing they want to do is pull out their phone and take pictures and upload to Instagram. So what I like to do is, and this is in general entertaining anyone, I have Wi-Fi password all up on the wall in different parts of the wall. I tell people where the bathroom is. It's sort of an introductory thing. But there's way more use of technology these days. And so, you know, as kids, we would play a lot of games. We still have games. But we like to section off parts of the house designated for children, designated for my younger cousins to play. We have another area that is for technology use, like television. We have another place which is for like the DJ and have a playlist going. So we sort of designate the house into different areas. The kitchen is always the most highly trafficked area for obvious reasons. But those things have been incorporated over the years.
So what kinds of food do you think are best for these big celebrations when it sounds like you've probably got a spread of ages and interests and different palates that are all of a sudden all together for this occasion?
Absolutely. My philosophy is go simple. Don't try to do all of the roasts unless it's you're up to it, you know, but really try to spread the weight out. So what we do is, you know, we'll cook a turkey. We'll probably cook some stuffing and some macaroni and cheese. But people like to nibble when they first come in. Sometimes they don't want, you know, a huge plate of food. So what I like to do is have a couple of things that they can nibble on. So whether that's some seasoned cucumbers or that's some spiced nuts or that's some breadsticks, you know, with prosciutto that they can wrap their breadsticks in. I like to have sort of mini bites available and, you know, a crudité platter, a platter full of vegetables and fresh fruits are something that kids can enjoy. It's something that parents can eat. It's something that all people can eat, even if you have vegetarian or vegan friends at your party. But I would say it's also important to think about who's attending your New Year's Day party, what are the allergies, what are the food restrictions, and try to plan your menu accordingly.
Well, and you talked about, you know, letting people kind of graze as they're getting there and socializing a little. And one of the recipes you shared with us, which people can find at WPR.org/Food Friday, is cucumbers with hummus and feta. And
yes.
That sounds really good to me. Why do you like to do that one?
It's, you know, it's so easy. Cucumbers are available all year round. I love cucumbers. I would eat them, you know, just as they are. But they're really delicious. And I find that you can turn cucumbers into an appetizer very easily. You can cut them into thick slices. You can even season them. I like to season my cucumbers with some salt, a pinch of sugar, and maybe even some smoked paprika. Mm. It almost takes on a barbecue flavor. If you're being very ambitious, you can add a little bit of garlic powder to it, just a little bit. And, you know, you can top so many things with them. You can top some cream cheese with a little bit of dill stirred inside and maybe, you know, a piece of smoked salmon on top, or you can do something really simple and just have your cucumber seasoned, garnish it with some hummus and some feta cheese that you can just sprinkle. And the last thing I love to do with cucumbers is just make a buttermilk dressing, you know, just some feta, buttermilk in a blender, a little bit of salt, and have that as a dipping sauce for my cucumbers. It's delicious.
Do you peel the cucumbers, Lazarus?
I don't peel them. But you know what? If you're using an organic organic cucumber, I don't peel it. But if you're not using an organic cucumber, you can peel it. Some people like to peel it because the flavor is a little bit different, the texture is a little bit different. So it's optional.
We're talking with Lazarus Lynch, known as the son of a Southern chef. He's an entertainment chef from Queens, New York, and he focuses on Southern cooking. And we're talking about New Year's traditions and great food to serve for a gathering. And kind of sticking with that easy to pick up and munch on maybe before the main course is holiday spiced nuts. And what kind of nuts, first of all, do you like to use, Lazarus?
I use a combination. My favorite are almonds or pecans, but you can do a combination of nuts. They all work the same.
So none of them get soggy or anything like that. It's really up to your taste.
It's really up to your taste, and that's one of the reasons I love this recipe. I usually have a can of all different kinds of nuts. You could do this with cashews. It would be delicious. And one of the things that I like to do is, after I've created the recipe and I've baked them off, you know, this is something that you can put in the night before, and they'll dry overnight. Mm. It's really easy. But then if you want to decorate your house, you could put these nuts into mason jars and then tie them up with some beautiful string or even some bows. It looks really festive, and it brings in the new year with a lot of nice beauty around your house.
So, Lazarus, what kind of spices do you use? It seems like it's probably anything goes, but do you have some favorites?
Well, it's really anything goes, and it's usually whatever I have left from from the
from
year that I
else.
Throw on my nuts. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's cinnamon, it's sugar, some nutmeg, allspice, ginger, cayenne pepper. You know, this is really like, think about the flavor of eggnog. Think about the flavor of, like, here in New York, there's spice nuts carts all around. So it has that sort of anise, cinnamon sort of flavor. But if you want it to go sort of in a savory direction, you can also do like garlic powder, onion powder, some paprika. Mm. You can keep the sugar, but sort of change the dynamics of what you'll experience when you eat the nuts. So it's really delicious. You could also throw in some dried herbs, like some dried oregano would be delicious, or some dried parsley.
Mm-hmm. I was also thinking maybe curry powder could be good.
Oh, curry would be great. Some turmeric and cloves, that would be delicious.
We are talking with Lazarus Lynch about holiday foods to both start the day and to eat throughout the day. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have favorite recipes to cook around New Year's? What traditions do you and your family have? Or maybe you have a cooking question for Lazarus. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll pick this conversation up in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. It's the last Food Friday of 2017, and we are talking about New Year's Eve and New Year's Day traditions with Lazarus Lynch, known as the son of a Southern chef. He's a chef hailing from Queens, New York, who focuses on Southern food and cooking. He's also the host of Food Network's digital series, Comfort Nation. And we hope you'll join in by calling 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite New Year's Eve or New Year's Day recipes? Do you have any fun traditions to start a new year? And do you have any questions for Lazarus about being a great host? It sounds like his parties would be the ones you want to go to. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at WPR.org. And Lazarus, I want to turn to this turned up collard greens recipe. It sounds amazing. First of all, what is it about collard greens that you enjoy cooking with?
Oh, it's so versatile. The greens are tender. They can be eaten raw, which a lot of people don't know. Traditionally, people cook them. They just have such an amazing depth of flavor to them. And they're also really high in nutrients. And so they're very healthy for you. I love to cook them the way I grew up eating them, you know, covered in beautiful stock and aromatics, and oftentimes having a salt pork or a piece of turkey bone inside of there. But I love to also just cook them in some salted boiling water and eat them just like that. I mean, it's just delicious.
So you just blanch them a little bit, and then you can either
exactly
eat them right away or combine it with these other things. Yeah, in the recipe that you shared with us, and again, you can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday, you have adobo seasoning, some cayenne pepper, and those roasted turkey neck bones. And I have to say, one of the things that strikes me about Southern cooking is it seems like just about everything gets used and nothing goes to waste.
That's right. That's right. And that's exactly why we, you know, use the turkey neck bones. We roast them. I'm also using, you know, a Scotch bonnet pepper. If you can't find a Scotch bonnet pepper.
That's a hot one, isn't it?
No, that's a hot one. You can use a habanero pepper, even a jalapeno pepper, seeds removed, because that's where most of the heat lies. But the reason I call these my turnip greens is because we're turning up the heat inside of the greens.
I love that.
So, yeah, it's a play on the act of turning up the heat in the collard greens, which I love.
Well, let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Lynn in Eau Claire is up. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. I was recently in California, in Carmel by the Sea, and had a wonderful, very, very simple appetizer that can be made for any celebration. It was some seedless watermelon, kind of nice cubes, made into like a pyramid shape, so you can imagine a Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. Simple dressing of olive oil, coarse kosher salt, feta cheese, and some roasted pine nuts.
Ooh.
And for the holidays, you could put, maybe hit it with some fresh chopped parsley and cranberries, or some hot pepper, you know, some chopped Scotch bonnets and some cilantro. But it was amazing.
You know, Lynn, I have to say, not too long ago, maybe in the last year or so, I saw a watermelon salad on a menu that had feta in it. And I like both of those, but I was really skeptical. And boy, I was won over immediately. That's a wonderful flavor combination.
It's great.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, Lazarus is, I mean, Southern cooking, I'm assuming watermelon figures in somehow.
Oh, for sure. I love that idea, Lynn, and that's a great experience. I love to cube them up, just take them, you know, right out of the shell, and I like to drizzle a little bit of olive oil on top, some honey, some fresh mint, and some cilantro, and that's just a delicious, and a little bit of salt. Some people in the South love putting hot sauce on their watermelon. Don't ask why, but they love that. It's a really fun way to just elevate a really simple fruit. You can also do that with melon.
That sounds really good. Thanks so much for that call, Lynn. And Lazarus, you also have a recipe, speaking of hot sauce, for sriracha honey wings. And you also add sesame seeds and scallion as a final touch. So there's a lot going on there. There's kind of an Asian thing to something that I think of as a pretty American dish, hot wings.
Right. Yeah. Well, we grew up eating a lot of hot wings, and we also ate a lot of Chinese food on the weekend. So I fell in love with this kind of cuisine working at a Japanese restaurant when I was in college. But the technique of frying is something that's very interesting. Instead of using a self-rising flour or just an all-purpose flour, I do a combination of cornstarch and flour, which really adds a beautiful crisp texture to the fried wings. Actually, I think it's just cornstarch and egg whites that I use.
Wow.
And it's just really the ultimate crisp factor that you want in wing. It's delicious. And it holds up for hours.
You know, well, that's what I was going to ask, because a lot of these foods, like we were saying, you know, you kind of want them out so people can, you know, eat a little, talk a little, eat a little more. And so those hold up well over maybe a few hours?
They hold up well. And you can just put them right in the oven. If you're taking them to travel, fry them in advance. You can coat them in advance, put them into an aluminum pan, and then just reheat them in the oven. They are delicious.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jerry in Oakdale, Minnesota is up. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. See, I'm wondering if you can give us a good recipe for some nice tangy buttermilk dressing. But before you do, can you tell me the difference between bone broth and chicken broth?
Ah, two good questions. So bone broth and chicken broth, what's the difference, Lazarus?
Well, a chicken broth is a bone broth, but a bone broth traditionally has roasted poultry bones that are roasted in the oven, and then, you know, water is added to it along with some aromatics. A chicken stock is traditionally just chicken bones. So a bone stock may have other kinds of bones inside of it other than chicken.
All right. There's answer number one. Answer number two, what about a good buttermilk dressing?
Yeah, I like to go, you know, maybe a cup of buttermilk, and I believe I have this on my website as well, but a cup of buttermilk. I also like to add in some sour cream, maybe about a quarter cup of sour cream.
So even a little more tang that way.
A little more tang. I like to do a little bit of, like, a teaspoon or two teaspoons of Dijon mustard, and just whisk together. It is so easy. And then a little bit of coarse black pepper. I love doing that.
Wow, that sounds great. And that would go well with the cucumber, as we talked about earlier, too. Thanks
Absolutely.
For that call, Jerry. And Lazarus, earlier in the segment, you mentioned your dad's salmon croquettes. What is it about that recipe in particular of your dad's that you want to keep alive?
These are so special to me. These are sort of like your poor man's food. You know, it's salmon out of the can. It's not the salmon that's the highest in the fish market. And it's just so easy to make. My father would make them the size of his hands, I always say. They were the size of, you know, an average human face. And he would cook them in a cast iron skillet with a little bit of vegetable oil. And we would eat that with some tartar sauce or often on bread. And it's just the way to welcome the new year. It's definitely a recipe that was passed down from my grandmother to my father and from my father to me. And that's one of the reasons it's so special.
I love recipes like that. And actually, I love things like salmon patties, salmon croquettes. You mentioned a tartar sauce. Is there anything unusual about that tartar sauce? What do you season it with?
Well, I use Dijon mustard. I've fallen in love with Dijon in culinary school, and I've been using it ever since. My father, he used to use yellow mustard, which is also acceptable here, but that Dijon with a little bit of white wine inside of it, it just really takes us to the next level. And I also use some pickle relish, which is, you know, it's pickled cucumbers, basically, mm-hmm. with a little bit of sweet and pickle flavor. So it really helps to add the notch of flavor. I've also added some dill inside of the tartar sauce occasionally to go along with the fish. That's not in the recipe, but it's a really good way to increase, you know, the flavor.
And again, you can find that recipe and all of the recipes we're talking about today at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Lazarus, how experienced a cook do you need to be to make your recipes? Because I'm sure there's some people are saying, oh, that sounds so good, but I'm just not sure I have it in me. I mean, it sounds like there are, for really good food, you don't always have to be, you know, a cordon bleu trained chef to make them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, even though I've went to culinary school, my parents are not, you know, culinary trained professionals. They're just everyday people who love food. And so that's how I grew up cooking. And I think if you know how to read a recipe, you can do it, you know, and there are tons of videos I have up online that you can watch. But something like a cucumber, I mean, you slice it up and you sprinkle some salt and sugar. I think the idea around the holidays is to be stress-free, you know, no fuss, and really try to help use the folks that are with you to help you make these recipes.
Which can also be fun, and especially if you're incorporating younger family members, it's a great way to get them started in the kitchen, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Lazarus, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Are you someone that makes New Year's resolutions?
You know, I don't. I have never been a New Year's resolution person. I look at the New Year as sort of a blank check, you know, and it's like, okay, here we are. We can create a new beginning. We can create a new destiny, if you will. But I just sort of like to approach it, you know, with an open mind and really try to journal, actually, all the things I've learned and all the things I'm grateful for and try to pay it forward in the next year.
That sounds great. So how many people are you going to be having over on, I guess it's Monday, and what are you going to be cooking?
Oh, boy. We'll have probably about 20 to 25 people rotating in and out throughout the evening and into the morning. Well, you know, we'll cook everything. We'll have a ham, of course. We'll do my pineapple glazed ham, the macaroni and cheese. We'll do some cornbread. Of course, we'll have the collard greens. I also do a collard green barbecue salad with peppers and red onion, and it's delicious. And I cheat. I use a little bit of barbecue sauce from the store, and I make it into a dressing. It's delicious.
Wait. How do you make a dressing out of a barbecue sauce?
Oh, it's so easy. You just, you know, it's barbecue sauce. It's a little bit of apple cider vinegar, and I think that's all I do, and maybe a little bit of olive oil, and I just mix it up together, and there's your dressing.
Wow. Do you tell people that it started from a bottle?
Well, I do. It's actually one of the recipes.
You just said it on air, so I guess it's not a big secret.
Of course I do. I mean, I have no shame in that. But that's the thing. You know, use what you have available to you. Don't stress out. Something from the store is not going to hurt you. But it's really about the family, and it's about being with people that you love and celebrating good food. That's really what the holidays is about, in my opinion.
Lazarus, thanks so much for joining us. Lazarus Lynch is known as Son of a Southern Chef. You can find all the recipes we talked about at WPR.org/Food Friday. Well, Lazarus Lynch says he does not make New Year's resolutions. 55% of Americans say they will make them, but only 19% say they always follow through. 23% of Americans don't make them at all because they already know they're going to break them. Well, we asked a few people whether they were making them, and Bill here at WPR said he doesn't really make resolutions, but he figures if he needs to make a change, he just does it regardless of what time of the year it is, whether it's January 1st, December 20th, or May 9th, but he is hoping to work out more and eat a little better. We also heard from Susanna, who said she loves making New Year's resolutions. It gives her something to keep in mind and work towards throughout the year, and it feels good to be making her life better. And she is hoping, as she always does, to go someplace she's never been, and she's also going to make a will this year. Linda on Facebook says she's never gotten into the habit. She prefers short-term tasks, and she doesn't want to have a reason to beat herself up for failing at unrealistic long-term things that might not really matter in the long term. Well, if you have a New Year's resolution, we hope it includes listening to WPR in 2018. We're certainly glad you're here with us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.